Right. Thank you, Kevin and Amanda. I'd first ensure that we've all silenced our cell phones. Then I'd ask you please to help me welcome Shane M. from Huntington Beach as our speaker tonight.
I'm already kicking stuff. Shane, I'm an alcoholic.
Shane.
Nice to be here with you. I want to thank Lee and Jessica for having me. And everybody was welcoming. The potluck was great. We were talking. We sat back there and had a meal with some people. I can't remember if his name was Guy or Gus.
Guy.
I sat with Guy. And we had a talk about Grassroots Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way that it was back in, you know, when you, if you read the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've read the history. And it started in Bob's house, right? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous started in Bob's house. They shared meals together. They spent hours and hours getting to know one another. And the meetings that I go to in Orange County, they're probably nothing like what Alcoholics Anonymous originally was. And, you know, I go to a meeting on Monday night. My home group is a Seal Beach speakers meeting. It's in, we meet in Seal Beach, California, and Lee was just down to give a talk a few weeks ago. And there's probably, you know, 300 people, and it's a bunch of kids from the rehabs, which I don't mind, you know, everybody's got to start somewhere. But it's just, there's no intimacy in the meeting, you know, and I was going to a Tuesday night's men's stag. It was my home group for some years, for a couple of years anyways. In Sunset Beach at Thursdays, we meet at a club there, and Nomads Group was the name of it. And my guys were telling me, hey, you know, every now and then I get to share in a meeting. There's probably 100 kids there, you know, 100 guys there every week. That's pretty good attendance for a men's stag, and because we're there for the purpose of recovery. And the meeting's no business, or it's all business. It's no BS. And I was warned that I shouldn't use certain language here, so I'll be careful about the language. I'll try. But anyways, they wanted to go a little deeper, so we're doing something different on Tuesday nights. You know, I'm meeting with my sponsees, and I got another guy that sponsors a few guys, and we're reading about Bill's talk on emotional sobriety, and we're just going a little deeper, you know, for the purpose of recovery, because of the lack of intimacy that we have, then we're not making the connections in the meetings, because we go to these big meetings and these pretty meetings, and you know. It's just, it's okay, but I need more sometimes. So once a week, I'm getting a little bit more. The men's stag was great, I'm not saying, and it's still a men's stag, as a matter of fact, but, you know, sometime my sobriety date, okay, I've told you my home group, my sobriety date is June 21st of 2000, so I'm sober a little over 18 years now, and my sponsor is Aydin Akbarut. He's a member in good standing, and, Long Beach Alcoholics Anonymous, and at one time Lee was my sponsor, and Lee and I kind of used to work together, kind of. I'll take this off so you guys can see. I wear this pretty shirt. I can't even show it off. So I'll get back to Lee in a little while. So I'd like to be able to I could tell Tim's story. You guys know Tim's story? I could tell Lee's story, I could tell David's story, and I literally could tell all three of their stories. But I have my own story that I came to share with you tonight. But my story is actually a compilation of the people, you know, especially, the part of my story that is recovery involves these men. You know, they're the ones that, Lee was at my first meeting. Actually, I met Lee right before my first meeting. It's an amazing thing that I'm sitting here today. I'm standing here, and I'm with you guys. It's a miracle. It's nothing short of a miracle. And, you know, David invited me to my first meeting. So he invited me to my first meeting. He was at my first meeting, and I met Tim about 3, 4, 5 days later, something like that. And I've been in constant contact with these gentlemen ever since. And it's a beautiful thing. So I kind of did grow up in the Grassroots Alcoholics Anonymous that I yearned for, the reason why we started the group, right? And if you haven't experienced any of that, get to it, you know? That would be my advice, is that find somebody or some people that are the business that you connect with and do what they do and go where they go and spend time with each other, being involved in the lives of each other, because what else really matters, you know? And Okay, so I was born in 1986 in Glen... Okay, 1966. in Glendale, California. It's a suburb of Los Angeles. I'm sure everybody's heard of Glendale, or it's possible some of you haven't, but Glendale is... I was born in Glendale Memorial Hospital and was raised in Los Angeles in the Los Feliz District, kind of by Griffith Park, near Dodger Stadium is where I grew up at till I was 8 years old. My mom worked for the studios, and my dad was a trip. My dad was a bookie that lived in Burbank, and his side of the family, my father's side of the family, is all Irish, Catholic, alcoholic, I mean, to the old country, you know, like real alcoholics, like, and the ones that just, they never get sober. They just all die drunk. And alcoholism really killed everyone in my family on my father's side. It killed all the men that drank themselves to death, and the women died shortly thereafter because there was no one left to complain to. And so they died of a lonely, broken heart. That's for the Al-Anons in the room. So alcoholism just obliterated my whole family, you know, on my father's side. My mother's side was a little bit different. They lived in Glendale, and they were in my life. My father's side of the family was not in my life. My parents split when I was about 6 months old. I didn't have it rough, you know. I had a pretty good, you know, where we grew up at, it was a decent little neighborhood. There was some gang violence in the 60s and early 70s, probably near where I lived, but not like where I was going to school at. And I didn't realize there was a difference between races. I just thought people were people. I honestly didn't until I was probably 12 years old and moved to Huntington Beach. And because where I grew up at, it was Mexicans, blacks, whites, you know, everybody, it was just the community. I didn't know that there was a difference between people. I learned that as a kid. I learned about racism and that stuff. It's not, so I know that that stuff's not inherent. You know, you learn about that. And wow, that was a trip. I just realized that. Anyways, I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood, and we lived there until I was 8 years old. My mom worked for the studios, and she was a secretary, and she dated some guys that were, you know, in the industry, and you know, they weren't celebrities necessarily, but they were executives. She worked for CBS, ABC, NBC. My mom, she was an executive secretary, so she worked for a lot of guys and a lot of different companies, and some men that had, you know, some men that were, you know, kind of broke, and some that had a lot of money. And I always wanted her to marry the guy that had a lot of money. I wanted my mom, because I'm eight, and my father was this bookie and that was every now and then would take us to Disneyland or something, show up with $50 for Christmas, and he was an absentee father, like completely. He was just probably doing the best that he could, but point is this, she meets a guy who was a Vietnam vet. In 1974, she meets him. I'm 8 years old, and my mom meets a guy in Santa Monica at the Pike, and she falls in love with him. And he's fresh out of Vietnam, and it's 1974. He did a couple of tours. He was a Green Beret, like Lee, and you know, he'd seen some stuff there, and I didn't understand what was going on with him. All I knew is that they drank a lot. And my mom fell in love with this guy, and I was super jealous because I was the youngest son and I was mama's boy, and this guy was taking way too much attention away from my mom that I used to get. And you know, and then he hit her one time. You know, and I'm eight and I can't do anything, and she's in love, you know, but then they drink and they fight, and they drink and they fight. And it started with just the one, and it just started with the one, you know, it started with a slap the first time maybe, and then maybe it was a punch or something like that. And then, you know, he broke her nose and she had two black eyes. She was having to tell the people at CBS that she had been in a car accident. You know, it was one of those stories that you see that you can't believe when you're 8 years old is happening in your family. I had no history of violence. I hadn't seen anything like that. And, but I'm going to tell you this. At 8 years old, I felt like a coward because I couldn't protect her. Couldn't stop him. You know, he didn't come after us. I had an older brother. He's a year older than me, but he was 9 and I was 8, and I couldn't stop it. And I always felt like I was a coward because I couldn't do anything about what was happening, you know? And so I don't know what that necessarily has to do with my alcoholism, but I know that it played a strong role in the man that I would become later in life. You know, the savior, the protector of women, the defender of, you know, I was such a defender of, you know, unjust behavior. If I saw something happening at some point, you know, when I, in my formative years, probably in my mid to late teens, I couldn't stop myself from being involved in it, you know. And my mom got pregnant, and it was 1977. She was pregnant, and he was punching her in the stomach, kicking her, trying to abort the baby. And we had moved from L.A. to Oregon at that time, and he went to jail for a weekend or something, and nothing related to, because she wouldn't even call the cops on him. You know, she was past all that. Like, she was kind of stuck in one of those abusive relationships. They'd been married for a couple years, and so one weekend while he was in jail, she packed up and moved us back to Los Angeles and left him in Oregon. And I haven't seen him from that day to this. But the baby survived. It's my little sister. And she's the light of my life. You know, she's 10 years my junior. She idolizes me. God, I don't know why I'm emotional about this, but I love my sister. I'm capable of loving my sister because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got sober, before I got sober, I couldn't connect almost ever with love or attachment to anything. Like, I would have a girlfriend in my teens or something like that. And when I'm drinking, so I start drinking when I'm 12 years old, I can't feel that connection that I feel with other human beings that I do when I'm clean and sober. It's a completely different, it's like people are there in my life, but I don't have any. Like, if you're gone tomorrow, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. Parents die, grandparents die, stuff like that happens. I don't feel it. I'll attend the funeral, but I can't feel anything, you know? And I don't know if that's just my inhumanity, possible induced through my alcoholism. I'm kind of a sociopath, I guess. I don't know what else you'd call it, you know? I don't love anything really. And so here's what happened to me. I took a drink when I was 12 years old. We were living in Huntington Beach. We'd left that. My sister was born, and we're living in Huntington Beach. And Costa Mesa at first, and then Huntington Beach. And I'm going to school with these kids, and they're drinking, and I take a drink, you know? And I don't remember my first drink. It's not the same, you know, some people remember. I don't remember, you know? And then it was smoking weed, you know, cutting school. So there was a lot of drug use in the 70s. In the 70s, there was a lot of drug and, you know, combination. So it was pretty much, alcohol was on the table, of course, for all the parties that I attended, all the keggers. I worked at a little liquor store. We stole pints out the back and that kind of stuff when I was a kid. And I remember there was an Alpha Beta, if anybody remembers Alpha Beta. There was an Alpha Beta right by our house, and we would go in and we'd steal cigarettes and liquor from the Alpha Beta and drink it on the weekends or whatever. But I'll tell you, my criminal activity began immediately with my drug and alcohol use at 12 years old. I lived in a complex of probably 300 units, and it was a condominium complex, and the backyards were linked, and you could get on the garage, and everybody's garage, you could hop down into the backyard and just walk in the back sliding glass door. Every house was the same, all the models, so we would just go into the houses and we'd rummage around. We'd start looking for alcohol. If there was a purse on the table downstairs, because all the bedrooms were upstairs conveniently, and so we'd rummage around for a purse and try to find a little bit of money or something like that. But immediately I started with a criminal, because I'm 12, I don't have a job yet, I can't support, and I have a habit. Immediately, at 13, I was a daily drinker or user. Anything that I could get my hands on that changed the way that I felt, I was into it. And I don't think I ever met I only met one drug that I didn't like, and it was Marazine. Anybody know about car sickness pills? Anybody ever OD on car sickness pills? No? Dramamine? Marazine? Nobody? I'm the only one? Take about 20 of those and see what happens. 3 days later, I came out of it, and I never touched those again, I'll tell you that. It was an over-the-counter medication you could buy, and I never touched it again. And I never experienced anything like that ever. And I've taken every other kind of drug you can imagine in quantity, and that stuff about killed me. I think I was dying. So, never met a drinker or drug I didn't like. In my high school years, I fell in love with the cocaine that was going on in the 80s. And, we'd have kegger parties on the weekend, and my house was kind of the party house. My mom had remarried my stepdad. This is where my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was. There was a Serenity Prayer hanging from in our bathroom. I don't know why, but there was the Serenity Prayer on a plaque in the bathroom. And so I knew the Serenity Prayer when I was 13 years old is when my mom met my stepdad. And I knew that he went to AA to get work. That's what I thought. I thought you went to AA to get a job, because that's where he went and he would get a job. He was a roofer and he would go to AA and he would get a job. And that's what I thought AA was, man. I knew that this guy didn't drink and he was a great guy and we loved him and I loved him as a stepdad because he treated me like an equal and he let me smoke cigarettes, you know, and he'd take me to work with him and pay me like $2 an hour or whatever, but I would cut school to do it. So I was cool with it, right? And yeah, I loved Gene. And then we moved to Sacramento. He moved us up to Sacramento, and that's where it really took off for me. I mean, I spent my formative years, my true formative years, my teens, in Sacramento, California. And when we first moved there, so this is how I fit in. I come from Huntington Beach, and I have hair to the middle of my back. I'm a blonde-haired surfer kid, right? And I really am at that time. Not anymore. It's grayish now, but I was a blonde-haired surfer. It's gray. Okay, I was a blonde-haired surfer kid back then, and I was like, you know, I'm 13 years old, and I go from Huntington Beach, California. It's 1979. The punk scene is hit. I mean, every kid has a mohawk, green hair. They've got safety pins in their cheeks. There's all that going on, and my mom moves us to Sacramento, which is about 9 years behind trend and time. They didn't know what Vans were. They didn't know about any kind of skate. Nobody had a skateboard. There was like one little crew of three guys that nobody talked to that were skaters and punk rockers. And like where I had just left, everyone was, you know? So I kind of didn't fit in with the jocks, and I thought, I didn't think I could make a change here, but I have a habit already. I'm 13 and I gotta get high. I gotta drink. And so I gravitate toward the kids at school immediately that are smoking cigarettes and hanging out at the dead end behind the school, you know, at lunchtime and after school. And we're doing what we do as kids, you know, you know, I don't know. But Gene takes a drink, my stepdad, the one that had been going to the AA meetings for work. He moved to Sacramento. Now I realize he took a geographic and relapsed, you know. But back then, I didn't know anything about it. All I know is we had sober dad, and then we have drinking a fifth of Jack Daniels a day dad. And this dad was like nothing like the other dad. He wasn't violent because he already knew that story. And by then I'm a teenager and I know how to use a gun. So that's what's going to happen there. And he knew that. So he was a little scared of me. I think he was a little scared of me. He's a great guy though. But he meant well. He starts drinking and they break up, and I, you know, I begin my career. You know, my career was short-lived from I think 16 I was introduced to cocaine. I used it for a couple of years. Back then we were freebasing. It was before crack. It was before any of that. And I would trick people into, you know, because people would be scared. How are you going to pour cocaine in water and get your cocaine back? Nobody wanted to do it, but they all wanted to smoke the rocks. So I knew how to do that. So I always found a way to weasel myself into any situation where I could get high for free. I mean, if it was possible, I knew where the drugs were. I would take your money, go get the drugs, cook it up for you, smoke half, steal some from you if I could, whatever, you know? And that was how I managed to get loaded. I was basically a bottom feeder. I fed off of what other people's pleasures was my that was my get down, you know, because I was a kid. I was unemployable. Even at 15, I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't deliver newspapers. I would steal the money. I would deliver the newspapers for 1 week or something. I'd go to collect the money, and then I would just lose my job because I spent all the money. You know, I didn't give any to the papers. And that was my job, was how do I get what I need for me, you know? And it started young, man. Anyways, my mom puts me in a rehab when I was 18 years old, just turned 18. And my mom puts me in a rehab, and I go to an adult rehab, and I was just turned 18. I probably should have been in the adolescent one, but I go to an adult rehab. It was called Starting Point, 30-day treatment center. And I get sober, man. I get sober, and I fall, and I'm in Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous in Sacramento in 1985 was my first sobriety date, 15 years before the date I have now. And I get involved, and I'm convention hound. I'm doing all the stuff that you saw those guys, if you've been around that long, and you know what we were doing back then. You know, I got sober originally in 85, and I stayed sober, or kind of sober. I was dry for 5 years. I didn't take a drink again for 5 years. And so from 18 to 23, I lived basically as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for the most part. And around year three or year four, you know, if you don't work the steps and the change, I'm gonna state that my experience is, if you do not work the steps, this is an inside job. I couldn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and hang out and listen to other people talk and get some kind of a change that needed to occur for myself. I couldn't get it through osmosis. Without doing the work here, I was dead weight. And Alcoholics Anonymous knows that. And eventually, you know, I'm fist fighting in meetings. That girl's got a new boyfriend and I can't have that. You know? And, you know, I ran through people's lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't steal from you and I didn't do some of the things that I did outside of the meetings. But, you know, at some point an opportunity came to make a little bit of money selling a little bit of drugs. I couldn't say no. Because sober, dry, I was unemployable. I'd get a job, I'd keep it for a few months, I'd quit, take the money that they gave me, and I'd just move on. But I wanted all the things everyone else had. Everyone else had an apartment and a car and this and that. I wanted those things. So what was I willing to do? And I wasn't willing to work. So I started to... My fallback was steal and sell drugs, because that's what I know. I can only draw from my own experience. My experience told me that I could make money selling drugs. My experience told me I could make money stealing. So I started doing commercial burglaries, dead, clean, and sober. Going out at night and burglarizing commercial burglaries. I'm so embarrassed to even talk like this from the podium about it, but I did that, man. I had untreated alcoholism. I had no idea that I even had that. And I could listen to you talk about it all day and share your experience with what I was going through, and I couldn't relate. I couldn't understand, you know? I couldn't see until I could see, and I couldn't hear until I could hear. And that was the truth for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took a drink in 1990. I had a girlfriend. She danced. And she danced on occasion, and she was drinking, and then I was drinking. And I don't know about you, but it took me 10 years to get back. Once I take a drink, once I take one sip of alcohol, it's gone, man. I obliterate the memory of Alcoholics Anonymous and the friendships and the love that I have for the program and the people. And you know, not that I ever really had that, but I had a lot of close friends in AA. I grew up in Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous when it was pretty hot in the 80s. And but I take a drink, man, and the drink takes me. You know, I take a drink, the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. That's the story they tell, and that's exactly my experience. So I continued to sell those drugs because that was where the money was at. I was selling meth in the early 90s in Sacramento, in the capital of California. I don't know why it's the capital, but it is. Made a lot of money selling poison to your kids. Like, I'm not proud of that, man. And I mean that when I say that. And it's poison. We see them. I see the people still. And Lee always wanted to be John Wayne. Right? Everybody knows that, right? Clint Eastwood, John Wayne, I know all, believe me, I know his story. So, well, the movie that I grew up with was Scarface. And I wanted to be Scarface so bad. And I thought I would build an empire and have a little, you know, what, a tiger chained on the island and all that stuff. I really believed that, man. But I always forgot how that movie ends, right? You know, you don't think about that. You just think about the, you know, the money counting machines and all that stuff. And I made wheelbarrows full of money. I was selling meth in the 90s and I wasn't using it. You know, I was sober. And, God, I can't believe that. And then I took a drink in 1990 and I sold for a few years after that. And, I was still making money because it was just, it was a hot commodity back then. And then, you know, the longer you're in it, the more you're selling and you're making quantities and whatever. I made a ton of money. And I gave it all to the casinos and the whatever lifestyle that I lived, right? And in 1995, I was indicted by the federal government for conspiracy to distribute, manufacture, and possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. I got arrested in 1995, and they let me out in 2014. So, I got arrested in 1995, and they let me out 4.5 years ago. So I spent the next 2 decades of my life considering what I had been doing with my life, you know? And for the first 5 years I was locked up, you guys, I mean, I went from living a pretty, you know, whatever lifestyle to I'm naked and I'm in a cell and I'm being searched and I'm being told to bend over and cough just like everybody else. And I'm not special anymore. And everything that I own is on me at that time. Everything. And I'm naked. I don't even own the clothes on my back because there aren't any until they give me some, right? So I want to tell you about this. At first, because for a year and a half before, I had a love affair with methamphetamine too. I had started getting high on my own supply. I broke rule number one in Scarfaces, whatever, right? And I started getting high on my own supply and I had 18 months where I did nothing but I was being investigated by the feds. I knew that they were coming. I was scared to death. I was rampant with paranoia and everything that comes with when you're, like some people talk about, oh, they're tapping my phones, you know. They were tapping my phones. They were in the car, 2 cars behind us in the black sedan. For 18 months, they investigated me. And so like, it got to the point where we would knock on their window and say, gas up, we're going to Tahoe. You know what I mean? It was like, it was kind of a running joke in our crowd because we knew they were following us, they knew they were following us, and they knew that we knew. And nobody cared. It was just like kind of a, well, whatever, catch me if you can kind of thing. So when I got caught, I had been in meth-induced psychosis for about 1.5 years. And some of it was psychosis and some of it was real. You know, there's the real and the imagined. And I had built up 15 pending felonies in state court. I kept getting arrested and getting bailed out. I had a bondsman I knew from the old days when I was a drug dealer and I had a bunch of money and stuff. And he would bail me out and I would owe him more money and I would get busted again and he would bail me out. It was every, and so when I'm on methamphetamine, I have to have a pistol. I don't know about you, but I have to have a gun like all the time, 24 hours a day. I have to have a gun. It has to be loaded and it has to be within arm's reach of me at all times. I guess that's psychosis, but it was my truth. I didn't feel like I couldn't survive without it. Like my gun was my best friend. I had to have a gun with me. I don't know why, where that comes from, but it did. It's just the way I was. So every time I got arrested, and I got arrested 5 times in the course of 18 months, I had a pistol with me. And every time I was ex-felon in possession of a firearm, and I got a new case and a new charge. I'm in a stolen vehicle. I'm about to go pull this robbery, this burglary that's going to change everything, and I'm going to make $1 million and rob this museum and move to New Zealand or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know the heat's on and it's coming hard. So I'm doing crazy stuff. So when they finally do get me, and it wasn't very long, in September of 1995, I get arrested. And I have all these state cases pending, and then the federal indictment comes. But I'm still kind of in this meth-induced psychosis, and I think, okay, I can escape, right? Because you think, you know, you think I'm not going down like that. I'm not going down easy. I'm not going down without a fight. I don't have my gun, but I mean, I can do what I can do, right? So I get this guy who's a trustee to get this girl a visit or whatever, and I get possession of a handcuff key. And I'm going to make my break on the way to court because I have all these state cases pending. So the first trip to the court, I'd just been indicted, and the federal marshals are taking me to federal court for the first time. It's my federal arraignment. And the federal marshals find the cuff key.
Oh.
And I don't know what... I don't know if you can possibly imagine what happens when the federal marshals... and you're fighting like what's potentially a life sentence for my case, find you with possession of escape paraphernalia on your first trip to court. I spent the next 2 years fighting my case in solitary confinement, single cell isolation, no human contact, fed through the tray slot in the place that you see in the worst of worst lockups that you've ever imagined on. I'm going to tell you this, the Unabomber was 4 cells down from me. He was 4 cells down from me and getting treated way better than I was getting treated because he had all the press and stuff around him. He was getting all of his visits and all of his yard time and all that, right? I probably wasn't. I was cooking wine in my cell, trying to obliterate the memory of what life should have been and where I was. And, you know, when I got arrested, I had a dog and a cat and a wife and a 3-bedroom house. It was a rental, but a 3-bedroom house, and it was full of, you know, drug dealer paraphernalia and, you know, furniture and story, you know, stereos and motorcycles, cars, everything you can think of, right? And then I have nothing. And I'm 4 cells down from the Unabomber. And I just can't believe this has occurred. So I was cold for 2 years. Like it's cold right now. This is about the temperature it was for the next 2 years. I could never get warm. I don't know if you can understand. I mean, I could have run in place until I sweated, but then the sweat dries and you're colder than you were before you started. And did something to me, man. I was talking to myself at the end of 2 years, you guys. You know, I'm reading the paper out loud. I've got the paper, thank God. Somebody got me the paper, subscription to the paper. That was like a lifesaver. I read everything I could get my hands on. You know, you just read as much as you can. You sleep as much as you can. You eat when they put the tray slot through. And every now and then you go hard. You know, you flood your cell and cause a commotion and do whatever you got to do to get some attention, I guess. I don't know. That's what we did. Just to change things up for a little while. And I know that most of you don't understand what I'm talking about. That's okay. Some of you do. And... So off to prison I went. I took a deal, and my deal was for 23 years because they were going to give me 40. Make no mistake. In Sacramento in 1995, if you were a meth kingpin guy like whatever they were saying I was the chief lieutenant in a 26-man indictment. I was the number 2 man in 26-man indictment. My kingpin got 25. I was the chief lieutenant. I got 23. Another chief lieutenant got 23, blah, blah, blah. They gave out 180 years in my case. And they would have gave me 40, so I settled for the 23. It took me 2 years to get that deal. And off I went to state prison for 1.5 years. I went to a level 3 yard right just north of here. I went to a place called Pleasant Valley, which is not a pleasant valley. And I spent a little bit of time there, and then they transferred me to this place called Lompoc Penitentiary. Where I worked with Lee Carroll. And I met Tim and I met David. So I show up to Lompoc, and I'd been in prison for about 3 years at that point. And, cooked as much wine as you can cook. You really can't get away with it in the penitentiary. Heroin is the prevalent drug, so I'm going to use whatever I can to obliterate the memory. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, man. And anything that I can use to change the way that I feel, I'm going to try to use it. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's your psych meds or if it's your, like, whatever, you know. I'll use anything. But I found out you get addicted to opiates. I found that out. It's kind of crazy. So I got a habit in the joint, and I was trying to get girls to bring me drugs, and I went through all that stuff. I always had a weapon again, so I had a knife, so I'd go to the hole for having a knife. And so I'd back to the solitary confinement thing, and then I'd get out, and I'd go back to the hole for being under investigation, for introduction of, drugs to the penitentiary. And I like to play softball. So even, especially on heroin, I like to play softball. I'm pretty good. I play left center. I'm a pretty good player. And so I'm playing softball in the penitentiary, and this guy is going to come to me after the game and tell me that I can't play on the team anymore because I owe about $1 million in prison money at this point. In prison money, it's about a million. It's $1,500 in the real world, but in prison, it's $1 million. I'm going to tell you, if you owe $1,500, like, and you don't have their money, somebody's coming to get you, and they're coming to get you probably soon. And I had 20 years to do. I didn't care. Come get me. I got a knife. You get a knife. See what happens. That's really how I felt. I was kind of a tough guy, you know, back then. I thought I was. And I just didn't have any fear of my personal safety. I was like, I didn't really care about anything anymore. You know, my life's over. I'm doing 20 years in prison. And whatever happens here, man. If I make it out, I make it out. And I really didn't. I mean, I know for a fact I wasn't going to make it out alive. I wasn't going to make it out in the condition that I did end up making it out. But here's what happened. Instead of kicking me off a team, the guy who was kind of the shot caller for the team, he was the toughest guy on the team, he was supposed to come to me and tell me after the game that I couldn't play on the team anymore because I was too much drama. And they didn't want to be there when the shots were fired from me being in a, you know, armed close quarters combat fight on the yard because I owed so much money that someone was coming to stab me. I was literally there. It wasn't going to go any farther. Nobody was giving me drugs anymore. I owed everybody and I wasn't paying anybody. And I was telling them, I can't pay you. What are you going to do? That's where I was at. And instead of kicking me off the team, he invited me to a meeting. He was sober. I was playing on a sober softball team in prison. I was the only one that wasn't sober. I didn't have any idea. But David Boyd, Bank Robber Dave, as he's known in certain parts, invited me to a meeting on June 20th of 2000. And I came on June 21st. And I've been sober from that day to this, man. Nothing that affects me from the neck up. Nothing. Nothing. Not a little something to take the edge off. Not a little something to help me sleep. Like, I have been of sound mind for 18 and a half years now. Because David, you know, because he was inspired through what he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, instead of punishing me for my alcoholism, my drug addiction, but invite me to join the fold of what was happening in Lompoc at that time, which was strong. And I know you guys have heard some of the stories, you know. It was strong. It was a golden age of recovery, man. I got lucky, man. It was nothing short of a miracle that I'm standing here, okay? I had 15 years left to do when I got sober. And going the way that I was going, I was not going to make it out alive. Make no mistake. I wasn't going to make it. I didn't care anymore. What are they going to do? You know? And I wasn't going down in levels. You know what I mean? I was already in the penitentiary, so I was like, at the highest level, besides one place that they put people, it's called the ADX. It's an underground prison in Colorado. And that's where they put John Gotti and a few other people, right? That was the only place I hadn't made it to yet. I'd been, you know, it doesn't go any higher. I lived in a unit, it was called Murder Unit. And they didn't call it that because it was a nickname, you know? It was called Murder Unit because people were killed there. And I'm making it sound dramatic, but it was. We had what was called the mop and go program. At chow time, they didn't even bother locking the joint down anymore for stabbings. If somebody got stabbed on the way to chow, they would close the yard, close the hallway, mop the hallway, and open it back up. Some guy just fighting for his life in the hallway. 10 minutes later, we're just walking around like it's nothing. You know? And so I got invited to the meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I fell in love with you people. Same people right here in this meeting tonight. I fell in love with your stories. I fell in love with all over again, right? I kind of had a little love affair when I was 18 and I was sober for a little while and my friends were sober. But Alcoholics Anonymous then, man, I fell in love with Tim Wickham like immediately. Fell in love with Lee. I fell in love with Dave. I started falling in love with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that they were sincere and genuine, and they honestly cared whether I was there and attending their meetings. And I did like Dr. Bob did, right? Right in the beginning. I went straight to the people that I owed all that money to, and I told them, look, don't give me any more of your heroin, man. I don't have the money, but I'm not using it anymore. Please don't offer it to me, and I'll pay you back. I'm going to get this little job in a warehouse and in the penitentiary. It's called Unicor, and they're going to pay me $40 a month, and I'm going to get your money. it sounds kind of crazy, but I went to all the people, and I told them, please don't give me any more, man, And I was a man of my word, and I started paying them back a little bit at a time. It took me a long time to pay back all that money, but I would earn money and I would give them some, you know? And when you're making 40 or 50 or then even to $100 a month, you know, giving away 50 of it's kind of rough, man. It's hard to live off $50 a month, even in there. We buy all our own supplies. You buy shampoo, food, you buy laundry detergent, everything that you buy out here, we have to buy in there for ourselves. So it was difficult to do, but there was something about the sacrifices that I made early in my recovery with my time and the integrity that I was learning to build with telling somebody I will pay you when I get paid and then doing it. It was something that I had never experienced before in my whole life, right? I was starting to have integrity, and I started reading about this thing, man. I read the history books, all of them. I read everything I could get my hands on that was AA related. I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, AA Comes of Age, Pass It On. And then we even went farther, and I was starting to read some other stuff. And I had plenty of time to read, right? And plenty of time to read and to write. And I got busy right away with the fourth, Wayne Dowdy, who was recently released, one of my cronies, one of my original group members. Wayne Dowdy got locked up in 1985. And they just let him out this year. So he was gone for a long time. And or maybe 87. Anyways, he'd been in for a long time and he just got out. And anyways, he's 5 years longer sober than me. So he's 23 years sober and he's out of the joint. He's in Atlanta and he's doing well. But he was the man that took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he didn't even have to tell me. He's just like, there's a book in there. When you get to the point where it starts to tell us, he's that Southern accent. When it gets to the point where you says for you to write something down, boy, you write something down. And resentment, sex, and fears. And I wrote I told someone else all my life story on that yard in that penitentiary. I didn't leave anything out. None of the sick sexual stuff. None of the creepy stuff. None of the stuff that I was never going to tell anybody because I thought you would judge me or not like me or hate me if you knew the truth about me. And I told someone else all my life story, and something happened for me, magically, just like it talks about in the book. Like, the steps are designed to work perfectly to combat and actually cure the disease of alcoholism, if maintained. And that's what happened for me. I had a spiritual awakening. It wasn't immediate, but I had a, you know, it was experiential. You know, I had a spiritual awakening when I had worked, I don't know, it's hard to say you work all 12 steps in your first year because I wasn't so much passing it on. I guess I was through example, but I hadn't really gotten into meditation too much yet. I was saying my prayers, so I guess I was trying to improve my conscious contact. I wasn't necessarily doing a daily inventory, but when I was wrong, I was promptly admitting it. Like, I would be six, so I was a compulsive liar when I got sober. I'm not anymore. So everything that you've heard tonight is the truth, I promise. But when I say that I was a compulsive liar when I got sober, like, I didn't realize that it was a lie to tell somebody something that wasn't true. I didn't even know that I was lying. That's how sick I was when I got here. Like, I don't even know why I would tell you it was 20 pounds when it was a pound and a half. Or I didn't even know why I would exaggerate different things. And there were some memories that I had that never even occurred. But it was a story that I made up in my head that I would tell the story. Because I thought that you would like me more or accept me more if you knew this about me or something. I don't know. I was crazy. You know, we all are when we get here, right? And so I would go to somebody at 6 months sober, staff or otherwise, and say, I don't know why, but I just lied to you. And I feel like an idiot, but I'm sorry. And this is the truth. You do that enough times and you like want to stop doing that after a while, right? Especially when you're sober a while and it's people that you hang out with every day, you know? And so I learned to stop lying, and I started having some integrity with my word. You know, a little bit of integrity with my word at first. And in my actions, you know, with paying the people back. And then, I don't know, Alcoholics Anonymous just started working me. I was just attending the meetings. And then eventually, like I was telling you, I couldn't go up any higher. They dropped my points and they moved me from Lompoc to a penitentiary. They moved me to another prison. It's an FCI 1. It was a medium, not a high. And it was in Phoenix, Arizona, in Black Canyon. So I spent the next 6 years in Phoenix, Arizona. When I left Lompoc, I was sober 18 months. And when I arrived to Phoenix, you know, with Lee running the show there, I don't know if you guys know this, but Lee was a staff member. He facilitated the meetings. He brought all the speakers that we'd bring up to this meeting on Saturday nights. They would speak for us Saturday days and the penitentiary. And then they would come up and share at this meeting on Saturday nights. So we were having circuit speakers coming in to see us. I mean, for my first 18 months of recovery, I was getting like the best of the best. Whoever was hot in the 90s or in the 2000s, early 2000s, that was a speaker that was in Southern California, Lee was getting them. And he'd get them to come from farther. And thank you. You know? So they moved me to another prison, and I had been a changed man. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous had done its work on me. And so I went to the staff when I got there, and there was like maybe one meeting a week or something like that, and they weren't very well attended, and not many guys from the yard were coming. And I just left a place where we had 20 guys in the meetings, we had circuit speakers, we had 5 meetings a week, we had all this program, and I go to another joint, and it's in Phoenix, and I don't know anybody, and there's almost no AA. And I go to the staff and I say, I need a coffee pot, I need literature. I have to have AA here to live, because I won't make it. If I take a drink, I know what's happening. You know, I can't take a drink, I can't use any drugs here. I need AA, please help me build it. And they helped me, man. They got me a coffee pot, we had real coffee. They would bring in real coffee. I don't know if you know what that means inside prison, but real brewed coffee with grounds and everything is an attraction. It is. And in Lompoc, we actually got girls. That was an attraction too, like a huge attraction. Real women, not the other, real women. On occasion would come in, right? But in Phoenix, there was no women allowed. It was all men. So it was men's stat group. But I needed a coffee pot, and I would buy cookies off the commissary, and I'd buy the special vanilla creamers and whatever I could to help build the meetings, because I needed to build my own support group at that point, right? There was a few guys that were interested. They didn't have much knowledge of the steps and stuff, but so I started sponsoring guys, because everybody that came into the meeting asked me to be their sponsor, because I'm the only one with any experience. Sponsored a lot of people, took a lot of men through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 6 years that I was in Black Canyon. And I learned about the gifts of giving it away and what it was doing for my own recovery. And I was doing the work with them and reading the literature over and over and over. And nobody was doing 20 years. These guys were doing 5, 7, something like that. They'd spend a few years with me. We'd patch them up, get them sober, and send them back out. And more often than not, I would get a letter from the ones that stayed sober, and they'd say, I'm doing well out here in Denver, Colorado. I'm doing well out here, and I'm in Seattle, Washington. I'm in this place, because in the feds, you know, they send you wherever, and people come from all over the country. A lot of guys in Utah and New Mexico. And Yeah, so I sponsored a ton of guys. And then for my last 6 years, they sent me to a place called Terminal Island. Terminal Island's in San Pedro, California. It's in Southern California, right outside of Long Beach. It shares the port of Los Angeles. It's right there on the water. It's literally on an island. It's on a man-made island, but it's an island. So you're surrounded by water. So I had come from 6 years in the desert to surrounded by water. And I don't know, you can't possibly imagine that what happens to your body physically when you just get anywhere near where there's water. And for me, I'm an ocean kid, right? So I was just like completely revitalized. The minute that I got off the bus, and you know, even though I'm still in leg irons and stuff, I can immediately feel like this is where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be doing. But Terminal Island is, if you're in the federal system, it's the land of milk and honey. It's like every single person in all of the federal system, and there's like 250,000 people in the system, every one of them wants to be at Terminal Island. I don't care where you're at, you want to be at TI. And when I got there, it was kind of the same story. You know, I'd sponsored a guy for some years, for about 5 years, and he had gone to Terminal Island right before me. And when I got there, he said, you know what, the meetings here are kind of sporadic. The H&I, you know, it's good. They come in on occasion, but it's nothing like we had at Phoenix. And he didn't know what Phoenix was like. I mean, he kind of knew, but he didn't know what Phoenix was like when I got there. Because when we left, they needed a bigger room. Okay? They needed a bigger room for Alcoholics Anonymous when I left Phoenix. And it wasn't all me. I was a part of it for sure, but it was the same thing because I brought the Golden Age from Lompoc to Phoenix. And then Joe and I, who's a guy that I've been sponsoring now for, Joe's sober 15 years. And Joe and I work together today. I have a little remodel company. We work together. I see each other every day. We go to a lot of meetings together, and I've been sponsoring him for 15 years. And he lives right down in my area. But he was at Terminal Island, so we did the same thing that we did in Phoenix. And we built Alcoholics Anonymous the best we could. I went to the staff and I told them, look, I'm heavily involved in this thing. At that time, I was sober for a while. I think it was 8 years sober. And 2009 I got there, so I was 8.5 years sober. And we grew Alcoholics Anonymous in Terminal Island. And so when they let me out in 2014, May 19th of 2014, I left the penitentiary at Lompoc. I'll end with this. I left the penitentiary at Lompoc in 2001. I was, or 2002, early 2002, I was 18 months sober. And stayed in touch with the guy that invited me to my first meeting, that guy David, bank robber Dave. I stayed in touch with him a little bit through letters. He got out in 2005, was living back in Laguna Beach, and then I was in Terminal Island, and he couldn't come visit me or anything like that, but he knew some people, and he would send me messages, and he sent his girlfriend to visit me one time, and that was kind of cool. And I got this girl that I've never seen before. She's like, I'm Dave's girlfriend. I'm here to visit you. I'm like, okay, cool. She kissed me and everything. And this is from David. And but when I was released after almost, I think I was 19 years I was in, right? And when I was released, who do you think was at the gate? Yeah, David was there, man. My mom, my brother, and David were at the gate. And I hadn't seen David since 2001. It was 2014. And he was there. And he gave me a car and some clothes. Because sometimes we do that for each other. We help each other here sometimes with stuff. We give them jobs. We give them opportunities, a place to stay. And he did that for me. And, you know, those are the friendships that you build in Alcoholics Anonymous. Who shows up 13 and a half years later to say, hey, welcome to the world, man. And here, can I help you? What can I do? The people in Alcoholics Anonymous are the most beautiful people in the world. Make no mistake. There's no place that you can find better people than in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's been my experience. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm just saying I haven't experienced it. The most beautiful people are the people that I have made relationships with in AA. There's a caveat to that, is that I need to be the friend that I would have. I need to be the man that, and I'm not always, you guys, it sounds good from the podium, blah, 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 right? But I'm not perfect. Like, a couple things I don't do. I have a fiance and I don't cheat on her. And I used to, I mean, Look at me. No, I'm kidding. You know, you guys know. That was a joke. It really was. But I'm saying, look at me. You could tell that I'm a predator, right? You could tell that I'm like trying to scam on every girl in the room. I'm a ladies' man. I'm trying to get in your pants, period. If I'm talking to you, I'm thinking, I'm hoping we get to have sex later, right? That's the way I live my life, always, right? And I think that stuff sometimes still, because I'm not perfect, but I don't act on it. I'm faithful to my girl. I live with her, and I'm faithful to her. And I might have thoughts or whatever. I'm a human being, man. I got 3 billion years of whatever genetic programming to plant my wherever, you know? And that's just men. I hate to tell you, girls, but that's the way it is. But I don't have to act on it. And I found that I don't have to act on all the impulses that I have. I still have some problems, man. I gamble a little, and I shouldn't gamble at all. And I gamble a little still. And it's stupid, and I'm going to stop. I need to stop. David's going to help me stop some kind of way. I'm not very good with money because I didn't care about money for so long, and I've had so much of it at different times that I just think, credit card, that's money, right? So here's what my life looks like today. I attend 5 meetings a week on average, 4 meetings a week, 4 to 5 meetings a week on average. I sponsor a few guys, and I take them through the book, and we sit down, and we read. I don't do what I did in my early recovery because we had a lot of time to spend there, and now it's more about, you know, I work 5 days a week, I get off, I have to have 2 date nights to keep my relationship alive, and, you know, I have the meetings that I need to attend, and I pick up my sponsees before, and we go to the meeting, and I see my sponsor as often as possible, and that's what my life looks like today. I got a little company, and there's 2 of us, and every now and then I'll work alone, but for the most part, both of us are hired. I make a pretty decent living. I live in a really nice place. I drive a brand new truck. I'm well fed, obviously. I know you guys can't see it, but it's back here. It's right here. And I live a beautiful life because of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that took the time to spend with me and show me how to be a man of character, a man of integrity, how to be a friend and a partner and do what I say, you know? And they've been watching me for years and years and years, so they know that it's true. I wouldn't be here otherwise, you know? I can only pray that if you haven't worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that you do, because something will happen for you. Here was the difference. I worked the steps this time. I worked them to the best of my ability with all the integrity I could muster at the time. And I believe that if you do that, your life will change. And I don't know anybody nobody in AA that said they worked the steps and their life got worse. Not one person. Everybody says, I worked the steps and my life got better. I've been hearing that for I don't know how long, but everybody says the same thing. There's got to be something to that, right? And the first thing that you hear from anybody coming back from relapse is, it's the famous 5 words, man. I stopped going to meetings. I attend meetings regularly. I'll leave you guys with this. It's 8:05. It's 8:04. I got 1 minute. I used to read The Grapevine a lot. I guess I'm sure that you guys are familiar with The Grapevine. I read it cover to cover every month for many, many, many years. But I read one thing that stuck out for me. Stuck out for me. Stuck out. Stuck out. It stuck out. I carry it to this day, and it's this. It's heard from an old timer in a meeting. It says, you know, I'm sober a long time. I probably only need 1 meeting a week to stay sober. But I go every day because I never know which one it's going to be.
Yeah.
Right? So attend meetings regularly, work the steps with a sponsor, and Alcoholics Anonymous will do the rest, man. Have a beautiful life. Thank you for having me.
All right, our newcomers tonight were Jessica, and we had 3 visitors, David, Jill, and Shannon, and let's give them, as well as our speaker, another round of applause.